Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? Sounds
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, April the 10th, 2014, and it seems like it's too early to do this, but that's what everybody else is pointing at these days, particularly when you look at the news online. So, Bill, I guess we got to start looking at, can I dare to say it, the upcoming elections already? I think it's too soon, but hey, you know, that's what everybody's starting to talk about these days.
Well, it is an election year, so it's, you know, you're starting to get polls even on the presidential races. But actually what's coming up this week is April 15th.
Yeah, I try not to think about that. The only good thing I could say for it is I've almost got everything done, but beyond that...
No, I did TurboTax for myself and my wife. So it's pretty simple if you're poor and don't have much money and don't have many investments.
That's true. Although it can be a little bit more complex if you're poor and are self-employed and don't have many
investments. That's going to happen to me too. Yeah. Anyway, polls say Americans don't care. I mean, they say politicians are corrupt.
They had to take a poll to find that one out.
75% of Americans say Americans are stupid.
Okay.
Politically ignorant. I mean, that was a book that just came out recently about political ignorance and rational political ignorance versus irrational political ignorance.
Yeah. Well, you lost the entire thing. Is there a point in here somewhere?
I don't know. A Reason Rupee poll. Rupee does a thing and Reason publishes it, says that the public thinks that 75% of all politicians are corrupted by campaign contributions and that lobbyists. 70% of politicians use their political power to help their friends and hurt their enemies.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm puzzled. I don't know what the other 30% think they do.
That's a good question. If there are no other questions, we're done with the show.
I guess. Anyway, the poll asks, what is the more serious problem? Special interest groups spending private money on campaigns to elect the politicians they favor, or elected officials enacting policies and spending taxpayer money that benefit the special interests they favor? So 63% of Americans said officials enacting policies and spending taxpayer money was a more serious problem. I think they got that right.
Okay. Well, maybe the electorate isn't as stupid as the first poll thought. Well, isn't that what it said? That's what you told. Hey, look, I'm not reading these things. You're reading them.
So we have a poll for the 2016 presidential election.
Oh,
we don't need to run the primary campaign. We just you know, we've got the polls. Who needs any elections and stuff like that? You know, it's going to be.
You've got a lot of polls that are 2.5 years out. I mean, really.
Yeah. You know, why bother? It's just we've got the polls. Everybody's got their own opinion, and we'll just go with that. You know, it'll be Rand versus Hillary.
Rand Paul.
Yeah.
Really? He's at the top?
Yeah. CNN poll put Paul at the top, leading the field with 16%. Two other polls, there were national polls of various sets of voters, Republicans or Democrats or independents, whatever, put Paul at the top. Paul does slightly better than Chris Christie now, after Chris Christie's little problem. Does a few points better against Clinton. But in the early states like Iowa, Huckleberry Hound leads by a few points over Paul. That was from a GOP private poll. So anyway,
PGD
survey says that Huckabee is first with 17% and Paul is at 14% in Iowa. But in New Hampshire, Paul is quite a bit ahead of everybody else. He's 12%. He's at the top of the list. Very long list.
Yeah,
everybody else got less than 3%.
When you're this far out, that's definitely going to happen. You're not going to have any clear front runners leading by like 30% or something like that.
That's why I say, why bother with the primaries? I mean, the Republicans adopted a new schedule and a new procedure. They're going to veto all of the primary contest debates broadcasts. They're going to have only one debate. It's going to be between Romney and Bush.
Is that really a debate? I mean, seriously, what do they disagree on?
Jeb Bush is coming up in the polls because of all of the Bush people that like him, or all of the Romney people that like him, or all of the McCain people that like him. So anyway,
well, I guess I can think of one thing that they would disagree on, because Romney would favor Romneycare, but Bush wouldn't.
He would probably favor Bushcare. Well, remember his dad, or his brother, rather, did the Medicare Part D expansion.
Paid for prescription.
So that was the Bushcare plan. And they also tried to close the donut hole, but
I think Obama would probably call it the Bush I Don't Care plan, but, you know.
So anyway, we've got, who do you think is going to get the nomination? You think it's going to be Jeb?
Why do you think that it matters? I mean, seriously.
What you think matters. I mean, this is going to affect the votes of thousands and thousands of people, millions even.
If what I thought mattered, the NSA would already be shut down.
You don't get to vote on the NSA. You just get to vote on a body, you know, a person.
You want me to pick between Autocrat A and Autocrat B, right?
No, you pick whoever you like.
I can pick anybody else.
Probably Gary Johnson's going to be the LP candidate again.
Well, I think you'd be an amusing candidate.
I think I'd be a great candidate. I ran for Congress once.
I really think you should, you know. Miller for president. I like that.
I got a few political problems. To say the least.
But you don't think you passed the vetting? Is that the idea?
Something like that. No, I really ran for Congress, and all of the Republican groups I went to and talked to thought I was fantastic until they found out I was a draft dodger. Kind of turned off the neocons.
I can't say that I ran for Congress. I kind of walked for Congress. That was about it.
Walked for Congress? Yeah.
Yeah, and I basically allowed myself to have my name put on the ballot in 96 when Harry Brown was the Libertarian candidate, because I liked Harry, and Harry wanted to have a whole bunch of people to support him on the ticket. So I said, put my name up. But,
yeah.
You know.
So how many votes did you get?
Oh, God, you can count on one toe. Well, actually, I got, you know, my mom voted for me. And
Hey, good. Rest of the family, no, just mom.
My name actually did appear on the TV screen for a while, which is kind of weird. But then I sunk down to, you know, 1% land, so it didn't make any difference at that point.
Well, I actually got 30% of the vote.
Did you really? Well, so you really worked at it.
Not really. It was fun, though. We had like 15 different debates.
Or was it a case where there was no Republican? Is that what it was?
No. There were three Republicans. One was a multimillionaire. Of course, he's the one that won the primary, not me. There was a conservative political columnist and myself as Republicans. But the debates were all both parties. The incumbent was a fairly liberal Democrat. This was in Southern California. And so we had the debates with the Democrat, and there were several of them that were broadcast, and it was great fun.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I did. I'm not going to do it again, no.
Being the sane human being that you are. I'm serious. You have to be crazy to run for any kind of office.
You have to be able to talk over the top of somebody. You have to enjoy talking to people. You have to enjoy people insulting you and asking really stupid questions and stuff like that, but it can be a lot of fun, aside from winning the election.
You're absolutely right. Unfortunately, very few people actually pay attention to debates, despite, you know, whatever rhetoric to the contrary you might hear. People really don't pay attention to them. But they are fun. They're fun to be in. They're fun to participate in. Even if you're in a very strongly minority position where virtually everybody is against you, all it takes is to make a few points, and all of a sudden you get people, like, shifting uncomfortably in their seats. It's really fun to watch. I'm serious. There was one debate I participated in. It was a debate where the audience was heavily left-wing, but there was some strong right-wing minority influences there. And at one point, I don't remember exactly what we were talking about. I don't remember what the question was, but it had something to do with student loans. So I pointed out what happens when you pour government money into student loans is that it drives the cost up. And at that point, it had basically tripled the cost of college education over the course of like a 20-year period or something like that. So I pointed that out. And you could almost see the brain cells frying in the people's eyes. I mean, their eyes were glazing over, and they were thinking through, like, wow, does it really do that, you know? And then the best part was afterward, this guy came up to me. He said, I disagree with almost everything you said, but wow, that was a great point.
Well, the pincushion, and if and when they have debates, the pincushion for all the other candidates is going to be Rand Paul, because so many of them are going to, have a conniption fit over his foreign policy positions and, you know, a host of other things, but Rand seems to be impressing audiences. I mean, if you can go to Stanford, you can go to what's a black college in the South, and get standing ovations, he might be able to pull together a coalition that could beat Hillary.
Well, he's basically trying to play on his father's coalition, because his father did very well among the young on both the left and the right, and that provided some of the intrigue, if you will, as to whether or not his father was going to get anywhere. Ultimately, of course, the last time his father ran was the time that Obama was coming into his own. And, well, actually, he was already a president at that point, but he had also run the first time that Obama got elected, and Obama drew heavily in his support in the general election from the young, so there was kind of a shift that happened there. But nevertheless, the Paul-type message, the Paul family message, if you will, does play well in that age group.
Well, he seems to be much more interested in a broad range of different issues. I mean, Ron Paul would constantly talk about the Fed and about monetary issues and things like that.
That's what I do all the time. I mean,
yeah. Well, see,
but you're the one who told me I have millions of people listening to this.
Well, you do. You do. Yeah, there's nothing they can do about it. You know, they know everything is screwed up, but what can you do? You know. So anyway, we're going to talk about some monetary stuff.
Yeah, monetary. A couple of interesting things happening. I'm going to actually start off with something that doesn't seem like it's monetary on the surface, but it really is. You probably have heard about the Heartbleed vulnerability. This is the vulnerability in OpenSSL. OpenSSL, it has to do with website security and the ability to encrypt stuff. And the reason this ties into the banking and monetary system is that federal regulators have been sending out messages to the banks that their systems may very well be subject to that vulnerability. And this isn't a really small thing. This is a pretty big thing, because what this vulnerability does, it gets the attacker, it gives them the ability to basically get the keys to the city. They get access through this vulnerability to the high-level secret password that controls entire servers, and that includes bank servers. So you get a hacker in there who's got this capability, and he hacks into a bank server where the server is vulnerable, or it has this particular vulnerability. He's got the keys to every single bank account on that server, and that's serious stuff.
What's SSL?
SSL, secure circuit. I can't speak very well today. Secure socket layers is what it stands
for. Right.
And what it actually means is, I don't know if I can put this into non-technical terms, but essentially everything coming through that server, through its web port, if you will, is encrypted. In other words, it turned into a code to make it difficult slash impossible for someone who is monitoring that code to unencode it and figure out what the heck is actually in the code, what the code is hiding, so to speak, what it's encrypting.
My explanation is that when you're browsing, you see HTTPS instead of just HTTP.
HTTPS, that's a sign that you have SSL, or you get that little shape of the lock, the padlock that shows up in the browser window. That tells you that you're using SSL.
Yeah.
So it's pretty ubiquitous. It's
well,
all
I don't know, though, but is that really a problem for banks? I mean, banks don't use the Internet.
Banks don't use the Internet, right?
No, I mean, they don't. They have their own intranet to connect among the banks when they have exclusive fiber optic cable, so they don't.
Really serious,
although some
you?
Credit card companies obviously do because they process credit cards.
Well, you're going to have to try one of the more modern banks where you can actually do online banking.
I'm still trading seashells.
No, that's the problem, online banking.
Online
banking? Yeah, you can access, most banks now give you the ability to access your bank account online. You can pay your bills online. You can transfer funds between accounts within the bank and so on and so forth. Well, as long as that's online, that means the vulnerability makes it possible for them to get at your account.
Not unless they know the name of my favorite pet dog when I was 5.
Actually, they don't need to have that. That's the whole point. This vulnerability gives them access to the keys to the server, so they can just bypass all those passwords.
So they don't have to know. They don't have to know about Trixie.
No, you shouldn't have said that.
I shouldn't have said that.
Oops. Never ever say your password on the air.
That's not my password. That's my security question.
You and I are going to have a little chat about elementary security, I'll tell you.
My password is fracking.
That's an inside joke, folks. He was fracking. He was talking about fracking in our chat before the show here. Right. But anyway. but, no, your questions are good because obviously they're designed to help bring up the fact that SSL touches so many different people in so many different ways that they aren't even aware of. But basically, any time that you're trying to do something that involves money online, you're involved with SSL. And there's an excellent chance that you're involved with OpenSSL, which is the open standard servers use.
I read all these stories, and they always have a neat name for it, Heartbleed.
That was a good one. I don't know who came up with that one. That's very clever.
But what I haven't seen is I haven't seen any cases where the Heartbleed thing has resulted in any kind of documented losses. I mean, these hackers, they hacked into the Target, ATM things and, got all kinds of, passcodes and access codes for millions of credit cards. But I haven't seen any indication that Heartbleed has cost anybody any money yet.
How do you think they got into the ATM?
No, it wasn't Heartbleed. It was a system monitor that the service was being provided to Target, and the service had somebody that was not very scrupulous.
So your point is that you're not likely to get reports from banks saying, oh, by the way, we've just been infiltrated by Heartbleed.
Well, they do usually do that, but I want to see some bleeding hearts.
They usually do everything they can to hide it as long as they can, and then they release it in such a way that it makes it very difficult for the average person to put together that, that was the Heartbleed vulnerability. They don't exactly issue statements that say, well, we just got ripped off by Heartbleed. Biggest bank robbery in history.
Unless there's actual bleeding hearts somewhere, It's not going to hit the news. You know, people aren't going to.
No,
I mean, what can the average Joe Blow do about it anyway?
Not a heck of a lot.
This is for geeks. This is a geek
story. Not a heck
story.
Of a lot, but it's noting that it happens. And it becomes, I guess the real good thing you can get out of it is you can at least be aware enough to go ask your bank, have you guys checked into it to see if you have the OpenSSL vulnerability? The good news is that not all servers are going to have it. It depends on what version of that software they have. I have a web server where I have OpenSSL, But my version, this is actually a good thing. I actually have an older version, so mine is not susceptible to the vulnerability. If I had upgraded in the last couple of years, it would be susceptible. So it's actually one time when it was good not to upgrade.
Well, I don't know. We got all these new infections and stuff like that. But whatever happened to the worms? We used to have bugs in software and worms and, you know, animal things. Now we got heart bleeds.
Well, that's because there are so many of the viruses and the worms. I mean, literally, there are hundreds of thousands, even millions of them created every year. So, you know, at some point you say, well, it's not news anymore. That's why you don't hear about them. You want to find out about them? Go to semantic.com. You can find out all kinds of information that will really gross you out about all the different things that they're able to do.
Bugs and worms gross me out already.
Well, then don't go there.
Oh, okay, we'll go there. Anyway, on more monetary issues,
yes.
Besides these banks having to look for heartbleed bugs,
they're also looking for capital, I hear.
Is it a worm or is it a bug?
It's a bug. It's a vulnerability in, it's not a vulnerability in the encryption part. It's a vulnerability in the software that accesses the encryption, which is why it's such a bad vulnerability, because it basically allows you to get around all that encryption and get right at the original stuff.
So besides the bleeding heart banks, the banks, the eight largest U.S. banks.
Bleeding heart banks. Well, that's a phrase I never thought I'd hear.
The bleeding heart banks have to raise their capital buffers. And I'm all in favor of buffers.
Okay, now what exactly does that mean? They have to raise their capital buffers.
Well, it means that they there's a certain amount of moolah they have to keep in the back room just in case their loans go bad, because they don't want another banking collapse like they had in 2008, where everybody, you know, went wacky and invested in all kinds of stupid stuff and didn't have any money in the back room.
So if they do raise the capital, that'll prevent the banking crisis from coming in the future. Is that the idea?
It will never, ever happen again.
Except that it could.
Except when it does. U.S. banking regulators on Tuesday ordered the eight largest too-big-to-fail banks to raise capital levels in a bid to address weaknesses seen in the 2008 financial crisis. This gal is yelling at them, saying that robust capital standards, money in the back room, banks will need to raise a reported $68 billion in additional capital, which is essential to reduce the systemic risk. I can say systemic risk without stumbling.
Very good.
And mitigate. I can say mitigate, too. This Janet Yellen talks with big words. The distortions imposed by institutions deemed too big to fail. Now, I thought too big to fail had been, you know, crashed and burned, and they weren't going to even have any more too big to fail. But they do have too big to fail. So now the too big to fail's got to raise $68 billion, which means it's money they can't loan out. They have to stash it in the back room.
Well, Janet Yellen's been in office for, what, a month now, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
And already, I don't believe her. And the reason I don't believe her is that within the past month, the Fed released the results of its stress tests on the big banks, the banks that are too big to fail, and said that all but one of them passed. So why is it now all of a sudden they all have to raise their capital?
Well,
the whole point of the stress test was to say, hey, they were already able to prevent a problem in case there's another 2008-type financial crisis.
Yeah,
now they're saying, maybe not so much.
No. The regulators got confused. That's all. See, when they did it, said we have to have a stress test for the big banks. So they went to the banks and they got the executives that were the fattest. And they put them on a treadmill and they gave them a stress test. And so that's where they made the mistake.
Yeah. Did they put the heart in that they didn't have a heart? Is that the idea?
Right. They did not have a bleeding heart.
I see.
So they were fine.
And people wonder
I have not been drinking. I don't know why I'm being so crazy today.
I was beginning to wonder, but you know, I wasn't going to say anything. Tell you what, let's see. We'll change the subject a little bit and see if we can get you on a more serious. Okay, so while the banks are making sure they have enough capital, it turns out that they're doing very well with foreign investments.
Not
is that true?
No, it's not. It's not true. They're hiding their money overseas, so they don't have to pay taxes.
So they're lying once again.
No, they've been telling the truth all along. It's just that the politicians didn't realize that they wrote a tax law that lets people keep money overseas and not pay taxes on it. And
this is news that this has been going on for generations. I mean, the banks didn't invent it.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's in the federal tax code. The politicians invented it.
So why is it that the headlines?
Well, here's what happened.
Boy, I have to drag it out of you today, I tell you.
The corporations got smart. See, they said, well, you know, if we bring taxes back from our foreign corporations and declare them as profits, we're going to have to pay U.S. tax, which is like 35% tax.
Mm-hmm.
But if we just leave it over there and let it kind of sit in the back room for a while, then it suddenly becomes untaxable, and we only have to pay the foreign taxes on that profit. And the foreign taxes, of course, are anywhere from 5 to 20%, something like that. So they're saving all kinds of money. And I was actually watching one of the banking hearings that they were having. They were saying, where's all our money? You know, we're getting screwed out of $2 billion in taxes or whatever. And a representative from one of the advisory companies that had made arrangements for Caterpillar. Now, Caterpillar is a big company, and you know, they're worldwide. They're in every nation under the sun making Caterpillars.
Yeah, if you have a farm, you need a Caterpillar.
And so they sat down with this company and they figured it out. And it took them 2 years to change around their procedures and policies for reporting profits from all of their subsidiaries around the world. So they figured it out and they put it into effect this year. And then the IRS said, oops, we're missing $2.1 billion. And it wasn't just, you know, Caterpillar. It was General Electric and Microsoft and Pfizer and Merck and, you know, a bunch of other people that figured out what the law actually says and started implementing it to save their investors money. I mean, if they pay taxes, 35% tax on it, then their investors aren't making, a profit, whether it's capital gain or whatever it is. And so all these corporations finally figure out the law after a few years, figure out how to implement the law so they wouldn't have to pay the taxes.
Well, you think about it. I mean, Congress passes, I don't know if most people know this, but Congress passes huge piles of laws every year. I mean, you know, each individual bill can be like thousands of pages, and they pass them by, you know, the bushel. There's no such thing as careful passage. I mean, stuff just gets passed into law at ridiculous rates. Mm-hmm. You say no?
No, they don't do that.
What do they do?
They don't pass bills anymore.
Because they've
got too many Republicans in the House and too many Democrats in the Senate, so they never pass any bills. So what they did was they had tax laws written in such vague terminology that nobody could understand. So the IRS just decided to interpret it the way they thought was appropriate. So all the laws now are called government regulations. So all the bureaucracies are now writing the laws. They're writing their own laws the way they think that it should be implemented. And the interesting thing is that these laws don't have to be signed by the president. They don't have to be approved by Congress. They just become law. So you have something like 500,000 pages of federal regulations issued every year, but the House and the Senate are only passing like one or two bills, aside from post office namings.
So there's good reason not to have civics classes anymore, because there's no point to learn how a bill becomes a law.
Right. Yeah, you don't need that anymore.
Thing.
I mean,
why not just have laws that regulators make? You know,
This is the most efficient method of passing laws. You don't have to worry about politicians and stuff like that. You just, you know,
and the best part is you don't even have to win a vote. You don't even have to win representation.
That's true.
All you have to do is just hold an office, and you hold the office.
Well,
you're appointed to, and you get to make the law. That's pretty cool.
No. Well, you have to take the regulator to Bermuda and. Make sure he's got a nice hot sauna.
No, I was referring to being the regulator.
Oh, being a regulator.
Yeah, because he's the one who's ultimately writing it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, the regulators are the professionals that know exactly what needs to be done and how to do it. So they do it.
the professional was? That's the real question.
No. Nice.
Now, speaking of the regulators, the regulators are all subject, of course, to the various pronouncements that come out of the CBO, because the CBO knows all and sees all. They're like the oracle of government spending.
Yeah.
The CBO has announced recently that we're going to have massive growth, haven't they?
I don't know. You're going to have to tell me after the break.
You mean I have to wait till after the break to find out?
Yes.
Oh, well. All right.
Okay.
Well, folks, you heard it. Bill says we have to take a break, so we have to take a break. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back. We're back here at the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, Walt and Bill, and we're doing our fracking thing here. We're fracking all of the issues and news articles that we can find into little tiny pieces, and what's left is what we talk about. So
you were going to frack the CBO, and we had to take a break.
Yeah, unfortunately, I was fracking it the wrong way. I was trying to give you a lead-in, but it didn't work very well, so let's try it another way. From what I understand, the CBO says we're going to have drastic losses next year. Is that correct?
Well, it's 3% growth. That's the largest rise in a decade, but it, compared with anything else, it's terrible.
So it's good, but it's not so good.
Well, median household income is 3.3% lower than when the recovery began almost 5 years ago. In other words, we're all fracked.
That's an interesting thing. Household income is down 3%, but the economy's up 3%. And so that's a good thing, but it's a bad thing.
This is what bureaucrats do. You know, on one hand, it's a good thing. On the other hand, it's not so good.
Well, it shows just how insane the economic tools that are normally used really are. Like, for instance, the whole idea of GDP, as if that were a really good indication of the economy. GDP's been going up for, I don't know, how long? I guess since 2009, that's when the last recession officially ended. And yet, despite the fact that GDP keeps going up, which supposedly shows a growing economy, the average family sees their income going down.
Yeah. Well, they're saying, don't worry, it's going up 3.3% per year. By 2017, it's going to go down.
Oh, so it's going to
go down more than it's ever gone down before. It's going to go way down.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So slower growth in the labor force. People aren't working enough.
They're not working hard enough?
Not working hard enough.
So essentially, we're going to predict that there's going to be all this growth that isn't going to help the average family, and then when it's done, it's going to crash.
Yeah. That's what the CBO says.
Well, I feel a whole lot more reassured. I don't know about you.
I heard it on TV.
Well, it must be true then. Oh, good grief. All right, so how does this affect the unemployment picture then? Because I would think that while the economy is growing and getting ready to crash, even as the American family's income experience is going down, there ought to be some sort of impact on unemployment.
No, there's no effect. Unemployment is unchanged. It's still 6.7%. You know, way back when, you know, like 5 years ago or whatever, they used to say, well, the unemployment rate is, you know, somewhere under 5%. That's really good. So now anything under 7%, that's really good. So it's 6.7%. But they're saying that it's increased 0.2 of a percentage point for this past month, I guess. But nobody's working, so it doesn't matter. Because they're just dropping out the labor force.
That's quite a measurement, isn't it? You have a measurement of unemployment that isn't accurate.
No, it's accurate. See, what they do is they take all the people who have filed with the government saying they want a job and then compare that with the number of people who have a job. Now, if you've totally given up and you're not looking for a job anymore, and you tell the government, no, I'm not looking for a job. It's just, you know, impossible. I can't get a job. Then they don't count you. It doesn't count in the unemployment rate because you're not looking for a job.
That always struck me as rather strange, because when you've given up on looking for a job, why does that mean that you don't want one? Why doesn't that mean the more obvious thing that, you know, you and I would understand, which is, I want one, but I can't get one, so I just stop looking?
No, it isn't. It isn't that you're not looking. It's that you're not telling the government you're not looking. See, when you file for unemployment insurance, you've got to tell the government that you're looking. You got to persuade them that you actually applied for 27 jobs in the preceding month.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't, you know, if your unemployment runs out, you don't have to report it anymore. So you can be looking and just not have a job.
So basically, what we're talking about here is people who've been unemployed for so long that they wouldn't even qualify for the unemployment benefits, even if they could get them, and they can't.
That's right. That's right. So anyway, the number of people who have, quote unquote, given up on getting a job or have a part-time job or whatever is the highest it's ever been in like the history of the universe. It's like 63.2% are out of the workforce. They're not looking for a job, or at least they're not telling the government they're looking for a job, because they don't have to tell the government what they're looking for, whether they're looking for anything or not.
Mm-hmm.
So
essentially, then, the ultimate plan for improving the unemployment rate is to make as many people as unemployed for as long as possible, because then you don't have to count them anymore.
That's a good plan. Why didn't I think of that?
Well, you didn't have to. The president did, but, you know.
Well, the surmise of the media, the people who are well-informed, say this is because people are getting older. And I don't know.
Right, of course, because as they get older, they don't want employment anymore.
They don't want employment because they got all kinds of empty stuff like Social Security and things like that.
Yeah.
So anyway, workers over the age of 55, they actually increased their participation in the labor force by almost 1%. So it isn't actually the old people that are not working, it's the young people.
All right, now hold on a second here. First, you're telling me that the old people aren't working. Then you're telling me that they are actually doing the work, and it's not them who are not doing the work. It's the young people who are not doing the work.
Right.
So, if that's the case, why aren't the young people doing the work?
The young people aren't working either. Workers aged 25 to 54 saw labor force participation fall 1.9% since the beginning of the Great Recession.
Maybe I'm asking this question wrong. Let's try asking this a different way.
Well, this is statistics here. We're in.
I keep forgetting that. Yeah,
forgetting statistics. Demographic stuff. See, it's all a gen. What are we in now? Gen X or Gen Y or millennials or something like that?
Well, anyway, millennials are basically Gen Y. But yeah, okay.
The people who are dropping off are the kids, 20 to 24. They are the ones that are no longer looking for a job. They collected their unemployment for a year and a half or 2 years or 3 years, and now they're not looking for a job because they're going to college on a student loan and they're going to beer parties every night, and they can't afford the time.
And they're probably living at home with mom and dad because they can't afford to live anywhere else.
Yeah, or they're in a tent in a local park.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why they're not looking for a job. They should be looking for a job. What's the matter with them?
This sounds like a viable approach, doesn't it? I mean, this is the president is brilliant. I'm running out of hyperbole here. Help me.
No, I mean, we're going through all these numbers, but the point is that the way the government calculates the unemployment rate, you can't tell from a hole in the ground what the actual unemployment rate is because they count them in a totally weird way. They don't count the number of people who could work. They count the number of people who have filed for unemployment. And those people are unemployed, and everybody else that's working is working, and that's how they calculate their numbers.
And now mysteriously and miraculously, the workforce keeps shrinking every year.
Yes.
Which is absolutely bizarre.
Yeah.
I guess there's a lesson in there. The lesson is essentially twofold. First of all, you can't trust the government because they're obviously not giving us numbers.
They're doing the best they can, Walt. They're doing the best they can with what they got.
I'm not so sure they are, to be honest. Well, let's put it this way. I think it depends on what you define as the best. I mean, if the best is making sure that the government gets to keep their job and makes their friends wealthier and so forth, then I'd say they're doing a damn good job, a bang-up job of doing the best. If, on the other hand, the best is to work for the benefit of their constituents, which include young as well as old, then it's not so much, is it?
Hmm. Well, you know, you just have to have hope.
Hmm. Yeah, because we certainly don't have government help. Well, anyway.
Well, I mean, the government can't calculate the unemployment rate. They can't even keep track of the money they're spending. I mean, you take the State Department. That's Hillary's bailiwick, or was. They lost $6 billion last year.
Well, they do.
No, sorry, $6 billion over the last 6 years. It's $1 billion a year that they lose. They have no idea where it went. They have no idea who got it. They have no internal controls to keep track of where it goes.
Do they care?
No. But the inspector general sends them a warning. He sends them an email. He says, management alert. You lost $1 billion every year for the last 6 years. And the State Department says, oh, okay.
Oh, well, that'll do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Solves the problem. The alert format to report on programs or problems that remain unaddressed despite repeatedly being identified in audits and investigations. It says the first alert was issued 6 years ago, and he cited significant and recurring weaknesses in the Department of State Information System Security Program, which is to say their stupid accounting program isn't working. It's probably bleeding heart.
Yeah, probably the heart bleed vulnerability, but that's where the $1 billion a year went. But I mean, seriously, people often will criticize those of us like you and me who have libertarian beliefs, saying, you know, making fun of us for wanting to have a smaller government and so forth. And yet, you know, I look at stories like you and I were just talking about here, and I say to myself, why would anyone want to have that? Why would anyone want to have government where the State Department just loses $1 billion in a year over a six-year period, and nobody gives a damn?
Well, I mean, there's more money where that came from.
So just keep printing it up.
Well, they either get it from the Fed or they get it from taxpayers. You know, there's more money. You know, if you lose a few billion here and a few billion here and there, it's no big deal. I mean, I'm sure the Pentagon in there, every year they do a Pentagon audit of their procurement system, and it isn't $1 billion a year. It's like $10 or $12 or $15 billion a year. They just lose it. They have no idea where the money went. They have no idea what they bought.
They're not the only ones who lose it, I'll tell you. But
the other thing in the story was that they can't even keep track of how many contractors they have. You know, they're switching over from having government employees do the work to private contractors. So you have people like Blackwater doing all their torture work, and you have Caterpillars building roads in Afghanistan and stuff like that. They can't even keep track of how many outside contractors they have.
Am I the only one who can see this? You're missing a whole bunch of money, and you're missing a whole bunch of contractors. Why wouldn't the two go together?
Well, they're missing a whole bunch of unemployed, too. I mean, they just lose things.
You know, it's not terribly surprising them. They've lost track of the contractors. They've lost track of the money. They've lost track of the unemployment picture. I mean,
but
it's amazing they know anything at all.
But look, they're keeping really good track of people's phone calls.
Yeah, except even that they don't do very well. No, I'm serious. I mean, they're capturing.
That was supposed
to
be a segue into the NSA item about the Cuban Twitter.
Yeah, I know, but think about it. They're really not very good at it. I mean,
well,
despite every attempt, every successful attempt to violate every single right enumerated in the Bill of Rights, despite the fact that they've shredded that document in every meaning of the word, they still can't get a handle on how to use all that data. They can't process it all.
Well,
so, you know, I mean, we made jokes about, you know, them listening to the show. You know, undoubtedly the show is included in that massive data haul they got, but will they ever find it? Probably not.
Well, here's the thing. See, Congress passed these laws like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. So some of the laws were like passed in 1976 about the NSA and so on. And so it's the NSA writing their own laws about how they're going to collect things, and they get everything they possibly can. Like, for example, cell phones. They get, I think they said, one-third of American cell phone conversations. The reason why they're having a problem getting the cell phones is because the way the law is written, there's two different categories. There is a wire communication, and there is a radio communication, and nary the twain shall meet, as far as the law is concerned. So a cell phone that goes on a radio frequency up to a tower and then goes on a wire, they can't figure out, the lawyers can't figure out whether it's a wire or a radio communication. They're totally separate sections of the law. And, of course, Congress can't rewrite the law because they can't get their act together in order to, you know, update it. So it's very confusing for them.
Yeah, except I suspect it's not quite so confusing because we already know of numerous instances where they have this, you know, some law in their way and they get around it by, you know, going to one of their friends overseas, and the friends overseas don't have the same restriction, so the friends overseas do the bad thing, and then they just hand the data over to the NSA.
That's true. Yeah, GCHQ, those guys over there in Britain, they do pretty much whatever they want. They have a parliamentary system, you know. The parliament says, collect whatever you think you need, and let's pass that law. Hey, all in favor, say aye. And they do, and then the GCHQ decides how they're going to implement it, which means that they do everything they damn well please. But the latest news is actually not from Snowden, but from, it was from another source. It's called the Cuban Twitter scam. So one of the NSA projects is they have a bunch of people, like hundreds of people, sitting there on Twitter accounts, and they are putting out propaganda, deception, mass messaging, and pushing stories. Now, this is what they actually say in the NSA documents, and this is also being done by the Brits. They're going on Twitter and saying all kinds of nice things about the NSA or pushing whatever stories they think are going to scare people or whatever it is. And this is an actual program. And they found a particular one that was being done on all the Cuban Twitter accounts. And so they've got all these NSA people sitting there getting paid, they're getting $50 an hour or whatever, playing on Twitter. And, you know, putting out all this false information in order to scare people or screw up, politics in other countries. And that's fun. They enjoy doing that.
Uh-huh. So, essentially, the NSA is engaging in the same kind of social media campaign that, like, a small business would do, but on a massive scale.
Yeah.
And they're doing it for the purpose of deceiving everyone about what the NSA is doing.
Yeah, it's propaganda. You know, like you go on Facebook and there's a story that's posted there and there's some weird person that does a bump so it goes back up to the top. You know what a bump is on Facebook? Those are all NSA guys. When they find a good story, they just bump it. And so every time you see bump, you know, or there's a weird, really weird comment like it says, oh, you're full of it, that's a bump, right? It goes up to the top of the Facebook list as a more recent story. And those are all NSA guys.
So essentially, all those stories are NSA guys talking to NSA guys.
Yeah, yeah. We used to call them trolls. We don't call them trolls anymore. Now we call them NSA guys and gals. I'm sure there are plenty of gals doing it too.
No, wait a minute. Hold on here. Are you trying to tell me that all the trolls on the internet are actually NSA?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they. The guys are doing Facebook. The girls are doing Twitter, and
who's
the other
Pinterest?
Social media platforms like Pinnit or whatever it is. That's all girls from the NSA.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that's what they do to occupy their time, and they've got a big project going on, and they're building a new building so they can house all these people that are tweeting.
So are they hiring?
Yes, they are, but it's top secret. It's classified information. They can't tell anybody that they're working. So that's why the unemployment rate is so high, is because none of the tweeters in NSA are actually employed as far as the Labor Department is concerned.
Now, did I hear correctly?
Did I clarify that properly? I mean, it's a very important story.
Well, I think you clarified it as much as the government ever qualifies anything. So, you're right in. You know, you're on the right track.
Okay.
Did I hear correctly that President Jimmy Carter is not being tracked by the NSA?
He doesn't know. They didn't tell him. When he was president, they didn't know if he was, if they were, you know, they didn't tell him whether they were listening to his phone conversations or anything else. So he is being careful.
Uh-huh.
Told NBC, Meet the Press, that he doesn't use emails anymore.
Uh-huh.
Writes letters and puts stamps on them.
Because, of course, the NSA can't track that.
Yeah. Well, but he thought the NSA was probably spying on his emails because he'd been reading the newspapers lately. So he's using snail mail just to talk with the world's leaders about his latest, greatest project. And he's decided to avoid the NSA by writing letters instead of using emails.
Does Carter have Alzheimer's?
No. No, he has carrier pigeons.
No, I ask because he apparently has forgotten allegations that, about what happened under his own administration, because during that whole time period, not just his administration, but Nixon, Ford, him, Reagan, all those guys, you know, the big joke was that, you know, the NSA is monitoring the mails, and that's why the mail is controlled by the U.S. government, so that, you know, the intelligence community can infiltrate and inspect it and pick up whatever they want from it.
Yeah, but you're assuming that they told him about that.
Well, he was.
They don't tell the president. This is you know, for eyes only in the NSA.
Yeah, but you and I knew about it. Certainly, he had.
Well, we guessed. We just guessed. We didn't know. We don't know secret stuff.
Well, considering everything that's come out about the NSA in like the last year, I think it's a fairly safe bet that we were right.
Well, yeah, but we were just guessing before that. Yeah, it's. I mean, Carter's just guessing. He doesn't know whether the NSA is listening to him or not. He's using carrier pigeons instead of cell phones just to.
I think you can actually pass kind of like this general rule of thumb around. The rule of thumb is, if it's something that can be infiltrated, measured, read, studied, grabbed, put into a database or whatever, they got it.
Yeah, but you can whisper in somebody's ears, and they'll never get that.
You never heard of a hearing aid?
That hadn't occurred to me. The NSA is tapping your hearing aid. Okay. I got it.
Well, speaking of insanity, we've only got about 5 minutes left. Actually, got less than 5 minutes, I think. But it wouldn't be a complete show unless we talked about President Obama's favorite program. So
well,
what's the latest news for Obama?
We can spend the rest of the show and not even have to mention Barack Care, that other thing there. Because we can talk about the Boston Bombers.
Why would you want to talk about him?
Because there was a story. You didn't get the story?
Well, what was the story?
Well, this was a story on a report from the Homeland Security Committee. One of the Boston Bombers, I can't pronounce his name, Sarnaev, was supposed to have been pulled aside for questioning at JFK when he came into the country, when he, you know, went off to whatever it was, Kazakhstan, for terrorist training and how to build bombs and stuff like that. And so he came back, and Dagestan. He was in Dagestan.
Up, aren't you? You're just making them up.
No, I'm not. This is a true story from NBC News.
All right.
But he slipped through the immigration. And the reason was because someone at the NSA, that was, this is actually CIA, I think. Department of Homeland Security. What is that, CIA or NSA?
What makes you think there's a difference?
I don't know. I'm just trying to figure this out. Anyway, so it's the immigration group. It's somebody, you know, misspelled his name. So when he came back into the country, they typed in his name, so it's Tsarnaev, and they left off the E or whatever it was in the database. So they didn't have any idea that this guy was a terrorist because they mistyped his name.
In other words, they weren't smart enough to hire Google, which has this whole misspelling thing down to a T so that you can misspell almost anything and they'll find a correct equivalent in their database. They don't bother to actually have something like that.
No.
Because, of course, that would be an intelligent use of the money that they're misspending.
No. Yeah. Well, I mean, we already know the NSA doesn't have a an area code checker, because according to one of the Snowden documents, or some document somewhere along the way, their analyst went in and they said, oh, we have a terrorist guy, and here's his number. It's 202-456-789-1012, whatever it was. So the analyst said, well, you know, I'll just type in the 202. But he didn't type in the country code, which is 202 is for Pakistan, right?
Okay.
He typed it in the area code slot.
Mm-hmm.
The area code 202 is Washington, D.C.
Yes, it is.
So he got all of the phone calls in Washington, D.C. for the past 3 years, including everything, all the phone calls that Barack Obama made to his friends and neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And so that went into their segregated database for future investigation into terrorist connections. Probably the only useful thing that NSA ever did was by accident.
Now, remind me again, the reason we're doing all this is to protect the country against a potential terrorist attack at some point in the future.
You didn't know that every...
And this wonderful new system essentially let a terrorist in who actually set off a bomb and killed a bunch of people in Boston.
Yeah. But it wasn't Jimmy Carter, because Jimmy Carter doesn't live in D.C.
Well, now you've totally depressed me, and unfortunately we don't have enough time to undepress me, so I'm just going to hold you accountable for the rest of the week. That's all there is to it.
Okay.
Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
More so.
We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.